Infrastructure, administration buildings, some are simple terror attacks against civilians. The building here is a youth center. The woman who was killed is still lying just down there, covered in a blanket.
The woman was later identified as Maria Pirogova, a young deputy of the DPR authorities. Another killed was Vadim Lobozov, a singer in a music band.
Now, I've tried to talk to a couple of people at the scene here, but they didn't want to. They're simply too traumatized to speak. One man breaking down in tears by the side of the road. And frankly, my fixer, my translator, is very keen for us to get out of here because at any moment, these strikes can happen again. Right across the city, they've been happening today. And no doubt there'll be more anytime soon.
Andrei, the volunteer who took the mother to the hospital in Kubayevsky.
They shell the center of Donetsk on purpose, to scare people, to create an unstable zone in the city, so that people will complain, to provoke. To me, they're not warriors who fight with other warriors. They fight civilians. So I think they do not deserve to be called military. They should be classified as war criminals by a military court.
While Russia launches major attacks on energy infrastructure, in a shockingly underreported story, Ukraine is launching attacks on civilians, whom it claims to be its own citizens. Few people are on the streets today, as more strikes are expected. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Doors at food banks across the UK are seeing more people come through now than ever before, as food and energy costs rise. Beans, noodles and fruit. Food packaged up for people in crisis, not in the developing world, but in northwest London.
It's one of the thousands of centres across the UK. All this food is sorted, packaged and distributed by the volunteers here to people who desperately need them. Without them, they go hungry.
Sarah, who asked her face not to be shown, told us she'd go days without food so her three children could eat.
I go days without eating as long as they get fed. I can go days without it. I can do it, but it's them I'm concerned. It's worrying for me for them to go without food. But I can go without food for a couple of days or so. Just eat, drink milk, hot chocolate, yogurts and stuff so they can have a full meal. Like, everything I have, it's all for them. So, you know, it is difficult.
Independent charity provides aid to 800 food bank users. And with the UK's economic downturn making the poor even poorer, they're warning more people will be knocking on their doors.
According to the government's new budget, benefits will be increasing in line with inflation, but that's not until April. So that means our guests will continue to struggle throughout the winter for the next few months, throughout the rain and snow and cold weather.
Food banks are now at breaking point due to a tsunami of need driven by the cost of living crisis.
Regular donors are unable to donate what they used to. Funders have less money to give to support because of all of that was spent during the pandemic. So while our demand is still the same, the support that we need to provide it is running out.
Charities estimate more than 2 million people in Britain now depend on food aid. For now, help is around, with those in need hoping the country's economic outlook improves. The question is how long that will take. Sai Puriza, London.
A conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is dubbed Judaization of Al-Quds and ways to confront it. Experts, academics, and senior Palestinian officials have attended the conference. They have discussed ways to tackle the growing Israeli violence against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This, as Israeli officials have been trying to Judaize the holy Muslim city of Al-Quds in the past by demolishing Palestinian homes and building illegal Jewish settlements.
We are holding this conference to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to reaffirm the Islamic identity of Al-Quds. Holding this event this year is of great significance amid the escalation of Zionist aggressions against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state. The Hamas movement asserted the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Quds and refuted all Israeli claims to the holy city.
Quds was never a state or a capital of a state for the Jews. All the history indicated that it was part of Palestine, and Palestine was and still is a part of the Arabic countries, which is a part of the Islamic world.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Those who attended the conference slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime. In its final communique, the conference stressed the importance of protecting Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots. Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and has been turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
It's just another attempt to mute the voice of the voiceless. Pro-TV managers were not surprised by Eurosat's decision to stop broadcasting the news outlet, as they say this is not the first time Pro-TV is being banned in the West.
Well, this gesture by the West is not anything new in terms of Pro-TV and even some of its, sister channels. So it puts under the microscope the real intention behind this. So the way this appears to be is that it's part of a bigger picture of this maximum pressure campaign that's been exerted on Iran. I am sure there's some geopolitical interest involved in terms of trying to limit Iran's reach when it comes to the media. But in particular, obviously, another reason for this act by the West, which is really against the pillars that they actually advocate, which is freedom of speech.
Eutelsat is a French satellite operator providing coverage over the entire European continent, the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and the Americas. It is the world's third largest satellite operator in terms of revenues. In mid-November, the European Union imposed sanctions on Pro-TV over claims that the news network airs forced confessions of detainees in connection with the recent unrest in Iran.
I've been working here at Pro-TV for almost a decade now, and I can tell you that Pro-TV has not aired any confessions whatsoever, forced or unforced. So that shows you how such decisions by the EU and the like are based on unfounded claims with no basis in reality. And these sanctions on Pro-TV I see as part of the media war and their narrative control. They want to present the war with their distorted version of what's going on in Iran these days, and seemingly they don't feel much comfortable with Pro-TV challenging their narrative. So they would try everything to silence us or make us less heard, but we're not going to be silenced.
In 2013, Pro-TV was brought off the air in the UK after media regulator Ofcom revoked its license over alleged breaching of its rules. In the same year, it was taken off the air in North America after the U.S. Treasury Department placed sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Pro-TV was also dropped from the Galaxy 19 satellite platform that allowed it to be broadcast in the United States and Canada. Pro-TV has also repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on multiple social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube.
It's not the first time, and perhaps not the last time, that the West has attempted to pull the plug on Pro-TV. However, the news network says it will continue its professional journalism based on its motto of being a voice for the voiceless. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
A month after going to the polls, the results of the United States midterms are finally known. The Democratic Party has narrowly won a runoff vote in the state of Georgia, meaning they will retain control of the upper house of Congress, but with a mere 51-49 edge over Republicans.
They've come up with things that are going to help a larger block of people. Conversely, the Republicans are just pushing back and creating exclusionary not even policy, but just exclusionary commentary. So Republicans are going to make all these crazy claims. And I'm not being partisan. I'm just saying that's what they said they're going to do.
However, over the past 2 years, a small faction of right-leaning Democrats was enough to consistently torpedo the legislation of President Joe Biden. Celebrations are further tempered by the fact that Republicans won control of the lower House of Representatives, meaning Congress is now divided.
A divided Congress means that the United States is facing 2 years of political gridlock, with each party voting down the other's legislation, and then capped by an extremely tense presidential election in 2024.
Just like in the years 2000, 2004, 2016, and 2020, there have been widespread complaints about the integrity of the nation's elections. Much of the Democrats' loss can be traced to disillusionment and disinterest from African American and youth voters, whose turnout dropped to an estimated 35% and 27%, respectively.
I would say I'm not hearing too much about it. I'm 19, so I might be part of it. My friends probably aren't just talking about it very much. I think they're probably just too distracted, and they maybe think it doesn't affect them enough for it to matter to them. However, it certainly should, because it can affect them maybe later in life.
Many are now lamenting that the Democrats didn't do enough to win over the average voter during the 2 years they controlled both the White House and Congress, as they remained focused on the era of ex-President Donald Trump instead. Now that they have the subpoena power, Republicans are looking for payback, meaning an even worse era of partisanship will likely be inaugurated on January 3rd. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
A Church of England disciplinary tribunal for Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal, to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person, and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I, and so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. It can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form and needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying, We agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him and the Palestinian cause. Saeed Burr up London.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out-of-control energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fans from around the world supporting their national teams along with other soccer fans at the Qatar World Cup have displayed their strong opposition toward the fake regime of Israel in another slap in the face for the occupying regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote, "How does it feel to be an Israeli in Qatar?" The question came from the Zionist regime's Channel 12 studio to Ohad Hamou, its correspondent at the World Cup in Doha. Hamou's answer was revealing. "Our presence here with the Israeli flag and Hebrew language is problematic," Hamou said, before Channel 12 showed a clip of him trying to interview a fan in Arabic, who insisted there was no such thing as Israel, only Palestine. "There are many attempts from people here from Arab countries to oppose us," Hamou said, while telling his audience that on a personal security level, he felt safe. We signed 4 normalization agreements with Arab regimes over the past few years, he went on, to lament. Yet most Arabs, he had spoken, did not want him there. Endless clips from Doha on social media of young Arab football fans refusing interviews with the Zionist regime journalist, the Palestinian flag being held high or draped over shoulders, suggests that the Zionist regime's much-vaunted attempts at normalizing with the Arab world has gone as far as a few heads of government, and no further. What the World Cup 2022 edition seems to have made clear is that ordinary Arabs still look at the Zionist regime as a colonial intrusion whose existence they instinctively reject and still look to Palestinians as their brethren. Dor Hoffman, a correspondent for Khan, an Israeli regime broadcaster, talked about his personal experience in Qatar. The studio had caught him on what he professed was a bad day. "It started when we ordered a taxi," he began, before relating how the driver had dropped him and his crew on the side of the road when he learned they were Israeli, refusing payment. He said, "We are killing his brethren." That was just the beginning. When he and his crew later went to a restaurant, Hoffman told his viewers, the owner, after learning they were Israeli, had them thrown out. "He took my phone and requested that I delete every picture taken in his restaurant," he said. The examples are numerous, and many short videos have spread on social media. In one, the journalist asks a man, "Are you Qatari?" The man replies in the affirmative and then asks which channel is asking. The journalist says he's from Israel, and the man walks away saying, "Sorry." The journalist tries to talk to 2 other men nearby, but they simply ignore him and continue walking. In another clip, an Israeli journalist is speaking Arabic with a group of young Arabs. He asks if they are from Lebanon, and when one says yes, he tells them, "I am from Israel." One of the Lebanese men asks, "You're from Israel?" The journalist affirms. They all turn around and walk away. And as they do, one of them says to the journalist, "Why did you come here? It is Palestine. Israel doesn't exist." Elsewhere, a journalist from the Zionist regime doing a live feed with 2 Egyptian youth says in Hebrew, "We came together to watch the soccer match. Are you happy?" One of the Egyptians ignores him and instead says into the microphone, "Viva Palestine." Another clip shows an Israeli journalist doing a piece to camera. A group of Arab supporters standing at a short distance chant, "Get out!" and "Palestine, Palestine," while waving Palestinian flags. In another clip, an Israeli journalist in a market tries to speak, at first very welcoming Qatar youth. Once he heard the crew was from Israel, however, he immediately changed attitude and refused to be interviewed. So it goes on, and all those clips told just one story. Whatever the positions of their governments, these were the real opinions of Arabs toward the colonialist Israeli regime. The extensive efforts by the Zionist regime over the past few years to break its psychological isolation and to open up its Arab surroundings have succeeded only at the official level. In Israeli calculations, any success in reaching out to Arab masses is a step toward normalizing the Zionist regime's existence. As a result, Israeli journalists put up with their isolation and humiliation in an attempt to break the psychological barrier among Arabs. They try to convey the Arabs that essentially they are just the same. The Zionist regime attempts to use soft power to break through any small opening, whether in sports, culture, art, or economy, to disincentivize Arabs to the Zionist regime's existence. Unofficial ambassadors, in this case, journalists at the World Cup, appear disarming in jeans and t-shirts to change the stereotypical impression of the Israeli as an armed troop chasing children or bombing innocent Palestinian people. Such cosmetic attempts come up against a collective Arab knowledge of how the fabricated regime of Israel came to be. Arabs know full well the campaign of terror, ethnic cleansing and massacres against their Palestinian brethren that made way for the Zionist regime. This regime is not normal. It cannot enjoy the same stability in relations as normal states. The Zionist regime was imposed on the region through brutal colonial force. Its citizens were brought to replace Palestinians, who in turn were uprooted from their homeland. The Arab rejection of the Zionist regime's presence in Qatar World Cup also highlights the glaring chasm between official policies and popular attitudes in the Arab world, a chasm to be expected due to the absence of democracy. The Zionist regime may have succeeded in signing agreements with a number of Arab countries whose regimes are susceptible to political and economic pressure. However, no one can force the Arab people to accept the fabricated regime of Israel. Ohad Hamoud, the Israeli journalist, summarized the situation quite accurately. Personal security, he said, is fine. However, many among the people reject our existence. Governments can guarantee security at official events. However, they cannot force the people to welcome colonialists. Palestinian flags have been waved at almost every match. Fans, and in some cases even footballers, have draped themselves in the Palestinian flag. Morocco celebrated their victory by raising the Palestinian flag. Palestine has been the winner in this World Cup. Arab regimes can pursue normalization, but the people of Arab world will have the final say. The enormous support shown for Palestine at the World Cup prompted the Brazilian writer Daniel Mondin to devote an entire article to Palestine, described as the 33rd contestant in the tournament. Palestine, the nation that fights for a recognition that has already come in football, he wrote in Brazil's O Globo newspaper, is the one that unites the Arab countries in the World Cup. For Palestinians, meanwhile, the footage of Arab youth telling Israeli journalists there is no Israel, only Palestine, engenders hope and relief that the true identity of the Arab people persists. Palestinians are not alone in facing the Zionist project, even if Arab support is currently limited to the moral sphere. Meanwhile, Palestine Chronicle's editor-in-chief Ramzi Barut has written, "Those who say that politics and sports do not mix know very little about the representation of football and the collective aspirations of people in the Middle East around the world." Ramzi Barut added, "To see Palestinians cheering for Morocco and Moroccans cheering for Palestine is one of the most significant Arab popular rejections of normalization with Israel." This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Under the guise of human rights, the UK, the US, Canada, and EU countries have applied sanctions to Iran. They've denounced the way that Iran has handled these riots without condemning the rioters and in an apparent support and encouragement for them to continue with their destructive acts. Now, Iran has been defiant in rejecting and blasting these countries, especially for their double standards when it comes to riots and protests inside of their own countries. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether these countries' support is due to a larger grand scheme of wanting to create instability inside the Islamic Republic with the ultimate goal of, quote, regime change. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Mohsen Nakhvi, human rights activist, joins us from Houston, Texas. Also joining us is Masoud Shajara, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. I will start with you first, Mohsen Nakhvi. Taking a look at the UK, the Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned the British ambassador, and it has accused the UK of continued, not the first time, but continually, for the UK to interfere in Iran's internal affairs. And, of course, to protest again about the new UK sanctions against Tehran. Isn't this a direct interference in another country's affairs?
You see, this is not the first time that the West has chosen to interfere in the sovereign Islamic Republic of Iran. And Rehber, on many instances, has clearly said that they don't have an issue with the Islamic Republic. They have an issue with a sovereign Iran, an independent Iran, an Iran that is not dependent on Western policies. And these interferences can be seen can go back to more than 60, 70 years when the British chose to depose Reza Shah because of his inclination towards Nazi Germany. And they literally interfered within sovereign Iran and placed his own son in power in the place of his father. And then the Anglo-Persian Oil Company and the fact that the British regime, the so-called British Empire, for so many years was looting the very resource of the Iranian people. This is not something new. This has been happening for a very long time. We can see in when the democratic government of Mossadegh was also overthrown through Operation Ajax, when the likes of Churchill and Eisenhower and Dulles, who approved $1 million to exile, to topple Mossadegh's government. So this is not something new. This is what the British regime, the West in general, has been doing this for centuries over centuries now.
Sure.
The only difference now is that the world sees through them.
That's well, Master Shajar, but this is unprecedented, isn't it? When you're having in a span of a little over 60 days, I could say week in, week out, we're having countries that are just either promoting and encouraging protesters, rioters, they're inciting violence, they're I'm not too sure if they're watching what's really unfolding out on the streets, but they continue to go at it with the Islamic Republic. Do you think the momentum, not only has it not broken, but it has increased, is a sign that maybe whatever grand scheme they had or plan they have is facing defeat?
It's quite clear from the statements prior to this situation in Iran that the West, Britain, United States, Saudi Arabia, Israel, and their allies are committed to sort of bring one maximum pressure and then through maximum pressure do what they call it regime change, i.e. change of legitimate government of Iran. And for them, these demonstrations are opportunity, which has been created and indeed been sort of encouraged. What we are really seeing is not sort of any love for freedom of speech. There is no love for the Iranians to sort of empower Iranians to sort of articulate their needs. What we are seeing is the incitement to murder, incitement to violence, which indeed both under national laws and international laws are unlawful. The reality is that we have in Britain laws that anyone encourages and incites violence, then it needs to be dealt with through the police and the due process and the courts. And indeed, if you do it in any circumstances, you get the wrath of the legal system and arrest by the police. Here we are seeing day in, day out, channels like Manoto, channels like Iran International, channels even like BBC are bringing people who inciting people to murder innocent civilian. And both here and overseas, we've got we are receiving so many complaints from ordinary people that is social media over these channels and elsewhere. Individuals are breaking British law day in, day out, and they're not being facing any consequences. We've got people who are so-called university lecturers who's actually going out and inciting murder. He's saying he himself is going to hang people in Britain and indeed over in Iran. He's saying that he's going to burn mosques in Britain and elsewhere. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, it's shocking. This sort of behavior is not tolerated by any standard, but they're being tolerated here because it's part and parcel of the plan.
Well, the thing is that you're having these, since you talked about the media, these are situated inside London. They're on London territory. And there's a regulatory body by the name of Ofcom that's supposed to monitor that. And based on Section 3 of its codes, crime, disorder, hatred, and abuse is a section of the code that covers material that is likely to incite crime or disorder is banned. And they either have to get issued warnings, and yet they not only are coming out with fake news, they are not, they're also interviewing terrorist organizations, but more importantly, they're inciting really violence through people, which we call rioters, that come out on the streets. Why do you think that organization, the regulatory body, is not enforcing its own rules and laws?
You see, regulatory bodies like AFCOM or FIRNA here in the U.S., for instance, they're basically set in place to serve a certain individual group of people in society. So FIRNA, for instance, is geared towards assisting the rich and the elites of the country, and organizations in Great Britain, like AFCOM, are there to be able to sell a certain narrative to society. So when it comes to Iran, or when it comes to South America or so-called communism, for instance, it is regulatory bodies like AFCOM that pick and choose what they want to tell the world. It's essentially, it goes against the basic right to freedom within the EU, meaning you want to be able to give both sides of the stories. Has BBC ever given the side of the Islamic Republic? Whether the fact that this government was chosen, was a popular government chosen by a referendum from the populace of the country? No. Whereas they tend to promote a small minority which is confused, and a lot of them are paid agents of the West who are propagating against the popular Islamic government of Iran. So these regulatory bodies are there to serve a narrative. They are controlled by the elites of the world to be able to serve those who want to serve the Zionist regime, to be more precise.
Okay. Well, one of the things, again, there's so many untolds that are not really being reflected as much as they should, Masoud Shajar, are the number of terrorist groups that are actively coming after Iran. And they are not only functioning on the outskirts and the poorest areas, but they're also penetrating inside the country. Thank God for the intelligence ministries and our security apparatus that has been able to foil many of their acts, which involve the smuggling of weapons. But looking at the most prominent ones, of course, the MKO terrorist cult were responsible for the death of 17,000, probably more Iranians at this point, or PJAC or Kamala, or we have Daesh terrorist group, which obviously was responsible for that Shah Cheragh massacre, in a sense, where you had about 13 people to have been killed. When you have these terrorist organizations assaulting Iran, why do you think this aspect of it is not being shown by either media or print or online accounts?
Look, West, under the leadership of the United States, have admitted through many of his representatives, including Mrs. Clinton, that they set up terrorist organization to do their dirty work, and then they got out of hand. So the fact that terrorist organization have been used for operation is a record, is on the record. When we look at groups like MKO, and we see that, you know, they have murdered American citizens, they murdered thousands and thousands of Iranian innocent civilians, and they served Saddam Hussein, killing both Iraqis, Kurds, and Iranians. Their record is very clear, and the fact of the matter is not only they are treating them as a terrorist organization, they are protecting them. They took them out of Iraq into Albania. They built a city within the city, and they have given them power to sort of organize and implement their hatred and indeed their terrorist activities. They are agents of the West, United States, Britain, and elsewhere. When it comes to sort of looking at the difference between riots and demonstration, it's very clear. And what does Britain do in these sort of circumstances? Bradford riots, you know, the judge put a standard, and he said anyone who picked up the stone and is identified on CCTV, even if they didn't throw it, they should get 3 years in prison. If anyone is holding a monocle cocktail and did not throw it and dropped it, should get 8 years in prison. And they actually went through CCTV and implemented those standards. There were cases of someone who took a stone and then dropped it, never threw it, was given those sentences, equally with the Molotov cocktail. In other riots, like the riots of London, they set up 24 hours courts to speed up and put these people who rioted through the courts. They give them prison sentences, even those who benefit from the riots, i.e. a T-shirt which was stolen through the riots in smashing the shops and was sold to someone and they benefit, they got custodial sentences. People are still in jail in Britain right now because of that. So look, this is not about the standards. This is actually organized deliberately to create disharmony and create havoc in Iran, as they did in Libya, as they did in Syria, as they did sure. in Afghanistan. And that is what it's all about. It's got nothing to do with the justice. It's got nothing to do with the freedom of expression. And, you know, the Iranian community, ordinary, innocent Iranians, they should be extremely worried that they are being targeted and wooed in this way.
Yeah, it should be very evident. And we'd like to elaborate a little bit more about what Master Chajari there said, Mohsen Naqvi, and ask you about what the UK Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has said, where he said it is completely unacceptable that people were having their lives disrupted by a selfish minority who joined illegal protests. Now, he's talking about that in terms of the UK itself, where you then had the Home Secretary who met with the police chief constable to discuss tactics that were used by some environmental protest groups. So you're having the British Prime Minister talk like that about his own people, but yet when it comes to Iran, no, it can't be, you know, that can't apply to Iranians. They need to do more. They need to come out, and it's okay. Doesn't this double standard really reek of, again, the wider plan that the UK has amongst a group of countries against Iran?
But you see, the West, and this can be seen all across the UK, the West. Sorry, I don't think the West has the higher moral ground on commenting on anything that's happening in a sovereign country, especially a country like Iran that has stood up against imperialism. The fact that the capital was attacked, was stormed inside the US. It was a protest, whereas all of those protesters, there are several thousand cases pending before the courts right now because every single individual is being tried who came and protested in the capital, right? And not just that, when we talk about sanctions and the role that the West has played within sovereign Iran, the one key role and the wickedness of the West has been to economically deprive Iran to instigate such protests. Right, a lot of these protesters are also extremely frustrated with the economic condition of the country, but they fail to realize that the economic state of the country, yes, there might be some mismanagement, as pointed out by Rehber, but it is also mainly due to the sanctions, the illegal sanctions that have been imposed on the Islamic Republic by the West, by the US. They went as far as sanctioning Imam Raza alayhi salam's shrine as well, which is one's basic right. If I'm an American and if I go to Imam Raza's shrine because Astana-e-Quds Rizvi is sanctioned, I cannot even donate a single penny within the shrine. Not just that, they've also tried to place intellectual sanctions on the Muslims by banning universities, by sanctioning universities like Al-Musfa University, uh-huh. by concocting fake and frivolous cases against them. Sure. So this interference goes beyond just these protests. They have a wholesome plan, which is clearly failing. It's quite clear that they have failed on the international stage.
Well, you have the U.S. also that has been very harsh, Master Chajari, against Iran. Well, it's been that way for quite some time. But ever since the unfortunate death of Mahsa Amini, we've seen the kind of media coverage that's been given in the through the lens of the way that you have these different channels that have portrayed Iran to, I guess, not deal with the women's aspect positively. Taking the U.S. Angle at this point, why hasn't the U.S. itself ratified the UN Women's Rights Convention? I mean, why doesn't somebody ask the U.S. that question, which then would not give it a right to come out and criticize any country when it comes to women's rights?
You're absolutely right. It goes far beyond that. I mean, United States has never been concerned about the plight of women, especially Muslim women. We saw they used that rhetoric in Afghanistan. And we saw what they did in Afghanistan and eventually how they run away and left all these people behind. You know, if if you look at how many women are being raped in U.S. military by their fellow soldiers and nothing being done about it, if you look at the level of rape in prisons, which is total control environment, you know, it really is pathetic. But I want to highlight one thing. You know, we talked about Britain and we talked about Mr. Sunak and Home Secretary. You know, when they're talking about stopping demonstrators, destroying people's lives, what they're really talking about, passive demonstration. They're talking about people who actually sit in the middle of the road and block the road, and they don't harm anyone. They're total passive demonstration. You know, what we are seeing in Iran, people are being encouraged to carry guns, knives, and kill people. We know how many innocent civilian and indeed security personnel have been murdered so brutally and been encouraged by their channels operating within Britain and elsewhere. Sure. So really the standard is shocking. They're talking about they should not tolerate people sitting in the middle of the street and stopping traffic. Totally passive. And then they're actually encouraging people to go and shoot their fellow citizens in Iran.
Well, there's a saying that says, Mohsen Naqvi, be careful what you preach. When we take a look at the EU specifically, we're taking a look at an unprecedented turn of events that have happened, which started with the conflict in Ukraine, where you have massive amounts of people coming out in droves, in the thousands, tens of thousands maybe, countries like Germany, the UK, and other European countries, where they are criticizing the government for their, I guess, foreign policy, and in particular the way they're dealing with the conflict in Ukraine, because they're suffering as a result of what's happening, especially given the fact that you have these governments throwing billions of whatever you want to call it, dollars, euros, pounds, or what have you, at Ukraine. So there's a problem that's brewing, and it's spilling out over in the streets. Don't you think they should worry about their own problems instead of coming out every other week and slamming Iran for its way of dealing with the rioters?
Exactly. And I'm really glad that you brought up the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Winter is coming, right? And they need to start worrying about their own issues. Not just that, the West in general need to focus internally rather than externally. They've spent too much time worrying about the world, plundering the world, looting the world. I live here in the US and there's no free free healthcare. There's no free housing over here. There's no free education in this country. The level of education is extremely poor. There is severe police brutality. The elites abuse the system here, right? And the populace within the US is sick.